For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. For those of you who are new, I'm Taigen, Lightning Teacher here at Zengate. I'm very happy to have given a talk this evening. Who is our visiting priest, Ratchet Springs visiting priest from San Francisco, San Francisco, Green Gulch Farm, is here for 6 months helping us, and he's a very experienced priest, just recently. Shiso, head monk at Katsuhara Monastery in Hokkaido, is going to be giving a talk this evening. So thank you very much, Pastor.
Thank you, Taigen, for inviting me. Thank you all for being here, sweating with me, as our air condition is under repair at the moment. So I think a lot of us are feeling that these are particularly tumultuous times we're in right now, and Taigen addressed some of that in the one-day sitting we had yesterday. It just seems like at this particular time there's so much that has been wrong for a long time that is rising to the surface kind of all at once. It's a little overwhelming. For tonight, for my talk, I want to focus on our practice of zazen. Not directly talk about what's going on, but how I find it related to a lot of the injustices that's going on, and how we easily manifest a similar kind of oppression internally towards the self. So I think our practice of sitting can be a powerful antidote to that if we apply it skillfully with care. So a quote from our Japanese ancestor Keisan Jokin. It's the fourth Japanese ancestor, so it's three generations after Dogen, and I think probably the second most influential Soto Zen lineage. This is from his advice for the practice of Zazen. Just mind, just body. Difference and sameness miss the point. Body arises in mind, and when the body arises, they appear to be distinguished. When one wave arises, 1,000 waves follow. The moment a single mental fabrication arises, numberless things appear. So the four elements and five aggregates mesh, four limbs and five senses appear, and on to the 36 body parts in the 12-fold chain of interdependent emergence. Once fabrication arises, it develops continuity, but it still exists only through the piling up of myriad dharmas. The mind is like the ocean waters, the body like the waves. There are no waves without water, and no water without waves. Water and waves are not separate. Motion and stillness are not different. So it is said, a person comes and goes, lives and dies as the imperishable body of the four elements and five aggregates. Zazen is going right into the ocean of awareness, manifesting the body of all Buddhas. The natural luminosity of mind suddenly reveals itself, and the original light is everywhere. There is no increase or decrease in the ocean, and the waves never turn back. Hmm. So I'm finding this quote interesting, and I'm basing my talk on it because it seems to be pointing to, Kesan says in the text, that body arises in mind, and when the body arises, they appear to be distinguished. And this sort of teaching that our mind gives rise to our idea of our body, and also gives us the idea that our body and mind are separate somehow. And if we take this to be real, if we don't question it, then we enforce this dualistic split. And we start to identify with our thinking mind and make our body into something other, an object. This is called disembodiment. To cause one's soul, spirit, or consciousness to become separated from the physical body. It's a definition I found. And this is, I mean, particularly strong in our modern Western cultures. Reggie Ray, who's a teacher in Shogyam Trungpa's lineage and one of the Western teachers that I think has been focused most on this body-mind non-duality and especially how coming into our bodies as part of our practice. He's got this to say as part of his reasons for it. He says, we have come to think that our lives, our fulfillment, lies somewhere other than where we are. In some other body, some other emotional makeup, some other age group, some other personality, with some other family, some other friends, some other job, some other city, street, and house, some other world, some other life. If to be fully embodied means to be completely present and at one with who and what we are, then modern people are the most disembodied people who have ever lived, always trying to find what we seek somewhere else. Does this sound familiar? Any of you tried on any of these ways to find fulfillment elsewhere or dream of it being somewhere other than right here and now? If only Zendo wasn't quite as hot, then I could really meditate. And we got this split too, you know, this Cartesian dualism is sometimes called, traces back to René Descartes, who I think it seems on a very, with a good mission, set out to sort of radically question everything and not take anything for granted and see what he found to meditate, really. But he was a novice meditator and didn't have any guidance. So he came up with this, I think, therefore I am, and this is really identification with the thinking mind and this separating it from the body somehow. I was in a lecture given by Kenneth Kraft, who's a Zen teacher and Gaichuan and professor, sat in on years ago, and he raised this, and he said, as Buddhists, if we got to sort of rephrase this, what would we say? And a couple of the responses I remember were given in the seminar was, I think, therefore I think I am. And you are, therefore I am. So I thought this. I sit, therefore I am. So this split of body and mind, you know, is we split it into, you know, body, mind, subject, object, you know, the mental and the physical, mind and matter. And we also split the spiritual from the mundane, right? So whatever is spiritual has got to be separate from the everyday life and the physical right here and now, you know, not on earth but in heaven, you know, and we've got similar teachings that you can see the attractiveness of them. And why they'd make sense in some way if you don't look too closely. And so, from a Buddhist point of view, then this dualistic split is a fallacy. But the consequences of it are very real. And if we relate to anything like an other, like a mere object, then we start to deny it its dignity and its sacredness, do not pay attention to it, and fail to notice its freshness and ever-changingness. And we fall back on a sort of mechanical view of our bodies. They become instruments for gratifying our ego, or we turn the other way and try to subdue them and sort of escape. And I think most of you know the story of the Buddha, and he growing up with all material desires fulfilled, and then setting on a completely different path, and almost killing himself in ascetic practices, and eventually finding this middle way between extremes. And I think both those extremes actually are based in this body-mind duality and way of seeing the world in such ways. And when we denigrate our bodies in this way, it's not just the connection to ourselves we sort of shut down. It's shutting down the windows to the world around us and trap ourselves inside our own little mind. And everything outside seems very scary. And we take our mind, all our thoughts, to be the way it is, and we don't question them. There's no sense of other information coming from this other aspect of ourselves. So we ignore our sentience, our ability to feel and perceive or experience freshly, and we only give value to our rationality, what we think. And once we've done this, sort of putting our minds over our body, mental over the physical in this discriminatory way, then this binary approach gets extended to all other aspects of our lives, all our other relationships. We classify them into this and that, and higher and lower, and good and bad. As Keisan says, again, when one wave arises, 1,000 waves follow. The moment a single mental fabrication arises, numberless things appear. Once fabrication arises, it develops continuity, but it exists only through the piling up of myriad dharmas. And when we start to establish these discriminations in our societies, I'm not going to go into how that happens and who might do so. The point of my talk is just to say that there are huge consequences on a social, global level. We place humans over nature. This is, again, the rational over the natural. And then bringing one under the domination and control of the other. And we do this, placing one sex above the other, connecting one to nature and one to being a rational thinker. And with race, too, of course, there's so many denigrating images and words that are used to, create this hierarchy as well, and to make us believe that it is so. And so when these hierarchies get established, they start to be taken for granted, and we see the consequences of that right now. So return to the topic of Zazen, and I just want to say that make it, I think, important point that a lot of practitioners of color have been making in particular, and that is that our practice is not to become colorblind and not see differences. That is, another way of denigrating the body, or placing the absolute over the relative, and establishing this duality is still in place. And we need our practice to include both the relative and absolute, form and emptiness, unity and diversity. And if we go with this sort of "it's all one" or "well, I'm not racist" mentality, then we fail to acknowledge the consequences in our society and our own embeddedness in that world. And my own, I should say, my own interest in, or you know, call to speak about this is, I'll read a quote of Earthlings first, actually. She speaks about, this is a book, The Way of Tenderness by Zenji Earthling Manual. It's one of the few, I think, African-American Soto Zen teachers in America. So it's Awakening Through Race, Sexuality, and Gender. It's the undertitle. And she talks about this way of tenderness as a way to counter all this, to include the absolute and the relative and to question our assumptions. So she says, the way of tenderness appears on its own. It comes when the events of your life have rendered you silent, when have sat you in the corner, and there's nothing left to do but sit until the mental distress or confusion about who you are or who you are not passes. It's an experiential, non-intellectual, heartfelt acknowledgement of all embodied difference. It's a flexibility of perception rather than a settling into belief. It brings affirmation of life rather than suffering, center stage. For me, myself, this is now almost 8 years ago, I was practicing at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. I was living for about a year and a half. And I basically ran my body into the ground and tried to do what I thought was the Zen way of just keep sitting with the pain that was gradually over a period of a year or so growing in my own back. And I did not know how else to relate to it but to try to push it away. It was frightening, and I didn't want to deal with it until I had to, and I could no longer sit zazen. I would be in the zendo on my back and out of the schedule for a lot, which was humiliating for somebody who thought of himself as and identified as an able-bodied young man. But what it put me in touch with was my own identity as able-bodied, but in particular in a family dynamic that we have in my family of four, where almost 30 years ago now, we were all in a serious traffic accident, and my dad and mom and sisters suffered consequences that they've had to live with for the rest of their life from that. And I was in the car but escaped with some bruises. And it became my role in the family to take on the identity of the one who was okay, who was sort of free. And part of the way I did that was I did a lot of sports and physical activities growing up, and then a little later in my life a lot of traveling, and it was a great support from my parents for that, because there was this joy that somebody in the family could be out there. But I also had the it was such an identity of being the one who was okay and able-bodied, that when my body was in pain and having difficulties, I did not know how to relate to it. It sort of touched on the pain of the rest of my family, but I couldn't face it until I had to. And it was a powerful practice to do so, and to learn a different way to relate to my own own body, and to really listen to what it had to tell me, and to experience through that practice how what's going on in my body has some correlation to what's going on in my mind. I think that my mind is in distress, that will manifest in my body as some tension or discomfort, and vice versa. So what is zazen? Just the way I see it this evening, I say it's an active engagement, physical engagement, and to not seek any fulfillment in any other place than right here and right now, in this very body. And it's a chance to see through our own mind and our ideas about the world and to question them. When we sit still, we can see the projections that appear and notice or remind ourselves that the teachings, that these are our projections, this is our thoughts. I think, therefore I think I am. To see how we're trying to pin down and domesticate this ever-changing and wild world that we live in by our concepts and ideas. So we just chanted the song of the grass hut, and Shito addresses exactly this in the song. In the verse, it says, "Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now." Another thing that zazen is, and as taught by our Zen ancestors, is as a ritual. It's an excellent article by essay by Taigen on zazen as enactment ritual. Is that the title of it? Is that the title of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same question.
Yeah. So it's basically a ceremony for the enacting the enlightenment of the Buddha. So it might not sound that attractive, and probably when you guys had zazen instruction, nobody told you that. But it is an aspect of our practice, and the way this has been handed down to us, and it makes a lot of sense if you think about it as ritual rather than meditation. The word meditation is, I looked up the definition that Google gave me, it was to think deeply or focus one's mind for a period of time for religious or spiritual purposes or as a method of relaxation. It's kind of the, it's very mental, it's not physical, whereas ritual, on the other hand, it's something that we do with our bodies, fully. We sometimes, we describe our meditation practice as zazen, which translates as sitting zen. So that's the posture in there, and it's central. And when you had zazen instruction, and those of you who have visited other meditation centers, you might have found that there's a lot of emphasis placed on posture here, and that's why. Suzuki Roshi says, "These forms are not a means of obtaining the right state of mind. To take this posture itself is the purpose of our practice. When you have this posture, you have the right state of mind, so there's no need to try to attain some special state." So, yeah. This sweaty zendo is just good enough. It's not... this temperature in here is not, if only it were a little cooler, then we could really sit down and meditate. It's actually practice, it's just to experience what is right here now. So there's some liberation in there, and some limits to where we think our practice might get us to. So taking the posture of the Buddha can be, you know, a very empowering practice, and it can be an opportunity to step out of a sense of self that's identified with a certain way to hold and carry our body. My Alexander Technique teacher that I was going to when I injured my back, he had this expression. Again, this is a, you know, rephrasing of the cat. It's a I tense, therefore I am. He said that the physical sensation of tensing is 10 times stronger than relaxation. And when our sense of self is sort of threatened, you know, our idea of who we are, then we're tightening a little bit, and this gives us this feeling of, oh yes, I'm here, you know, this is me. And we tend to take certain patterns that we, you know, repeat over and over again. And so there's a mind-body, you know, one influencing each other and giving ripples in the other. And they're not separate. So this empowering practice, you know, of taking this posture of dignity, and it's also an opportunity for tension to be exposed. That's the way, you know, the tension between our awakened nature and who we think we are, and that probably might show up physically first or in our mind. So the last thing I want to say is there is, for me, a neat parallel between this ritual practice of Zazen, the act of the liberated one with nonviolent social movements. If you think about the First Nation Canadian movement, Idle No More, this is in the name, they put this in, that's like, we're not going to sit back and let our environment get destroyed anymore. Or Black Lives Matter. Right? This is also something empowering, and acting out of is with dignity there. And it's also the exposure of tension that's already been present, but it's rising to the surface and being seen for what it is. If you think about lunch counter sit-ins in the 60s, this seems like a good example of that, of just going in and acting as, you know, liberated with full dignity and exposing the injustice for everybody to see. Cornel West was on Democracy Now! This morning, and he's paraphrasing Martin Luther King. It's part of Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail from 1963. So I want to close with some of this. And, you know, he's criticizing the what he's calling the white moderate, who's not the member of the Ku Klux Klan, but that's doing nothing to support it. And the letter is directly a critique of the critique he was getting of some Christian priest, all white. Is saying the white moderate is describes as more devoted to order than to justice, more interested in a negative peace that is the absence of tension than a positive peace that is the presence of justice. And say, I'm not afraid of the word tension. There's a type of nonviolent tension that is constructive to growth. So we can see that in our Zazen practice too. We want the tendency wanting to get away, and actually there's a really dynamic place to sit right in the middle of this tension of our, you can see it as an awakened nature, and who do we think we are, you know, I think is how it manifests. So Dr. King goes on to say, actually we who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. Bring it out in the open, where it can be seen and dealt with. Like a boil that can never be cured so long as it is covered up, but must be opened with all its ugliness to the natural medicine of air and light. Injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates. to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. I just want to close. This is the last thing, very last. A few words, more words by Earthlin, describing this way of tenderness. As a practice fully in line with this. If I were to define the way of tenderness, I would say that it is acknowledgement, acknowledging and honoring all life and all that is in the world fully, with heart and body. This acknowledgement is wordless and is expressed in a deeply felt nod to everything and everyone, an inner bow to life, so to speak. The way of tenderness is a response from below the surface of what appears to us when we are seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting, or thinking. It is a response beyond the mind, but of the body. It rises up quite naturally, without preconception, without our knowing the reason for the tears, fierce anger, or laughter that come with it. With the welling up of tenderness, we are like newborn babies simply experiencing the sensations of being alive. It is our own unique experience. So, thank you very much. Anybody have some questions and comments? We have a few minutes. And if anybody has another Buddhist take on this Descartes, quote, I'd be up for hearing that too.
Thank you very much, Haksha. Please, questions, comments, responses, feel free.
Yeah, Matt.
Could you say something more about you said that Zazen is a dynamic practice? Often, you think of it just sitting and it doesn't seem very dynamic.
Yeah.
Could you say something, especially in relation to what you're talking about, embodied practice?
Yeah. I mean, if you're paying, if you're looking at somebody sitting at the outside, or, we're not paying so much attention to it, it looks still, but there's actually movement, going on all the time, and each breath is different and unique, and there's with the breath, there's a certain circular movement of the body too. These little sensations, and I think it's dynamic too in the sense of what's going on in our mind will appear in our body, will show up in our body, and what our bodies are doing will influence our mind, and that's part of taking this upright, the posture of the Buddha is it's a state conducive to awakening, but on the other hand, we're not taking it in order to. That's
one of our ancestors said, outwardly still, but inside trembling like a tender cold trapped rat. So, what a trouble.
It's one way, it's a technique for making you feel alive. You're doing you, and there's something going on here, and you have to build up the tension, and it is. And it was understanding this that really helped me start to get rid of my time.
Well, it gives rise to a certain sense of self, right, that you identify with, yeah.
It really does, if you stop to think about it. Mm-hmm. You see people who are huffing because they're late, and you think, oh, that's
how they, you know, yeah. Identify. Yeah. Any other last comments, responses, any interesting things?
Yes. Yeah. I've been doing some Feldenkrais trainings, not lately, but there was one Feldenkrais teacher I had. His name is Dan DiLorenzo. And he is absolutely riveted by the process of how a baby becomes aware of its body and the different parts of its body and how it develops and be able to do things. I can't tell you the number of times I've been in a session and all we learn to do is turn over like a baby does. And this is it's a very studied thing and very important. And this person also has a class for mothers and babies, and it's called Baby Space. And it's a pun. Baby's space and baby's paste. And it's just what you said about you talk about the development of the mind meshing with or becoming the body, and I becoming part of it, or becoming aware of the body. And I thought about that because it's a very definite process of how the mind and the body are joined together.
I had a bit of an awakening experience. I had some Feldenkrais. Was working with a practitioner when I injured my back, actually. And she was pointing to some of the ways in which I was habitually using my body, and in this case, it was how I was standing. So I've been working on this posture and you know, getting out of this habit position that I tended to take that was not supportive for the health of my spine, basically. And then I had to do something really scary when I was standing up and speaking in front of people. And the voice that came out was sort of clear and strong, and, you know, the volume was good, and I was speaking coherently, and I didn't even feel afraid. And I attributed it to the posture that was, you know, was stepping out of my habitual self, and to, it was allowed for something else to come forth. So.